So anyway, I finished a month-long solo silent retreat 2 weeks ago. I try to do a solo retreat once a year. I rarely make it for a month because something always comes up. There's always some kind of emergency or something. But this year I actually made it. And this is all leading into clear comprehension in a moment. Like I said, it's going to be a little bit roundabout. But the guiding for my silent solo retreats is Majjhima Nikaya 19. And it's called The Two Types of Thinking. And the two types of thinking, the Buddha said, you should always look and categorize your thinking. What causes thinking and thoughts and the mind to be agitated, upset, to be filled with hatred, just all these negative places. And what in your life causes the mind to be at ease, to be happy, to be content? Doing a solo retreat is great because you can really look at these things. And what I give myself the opportunity to do is say, I can do anything on this solo retreat that causes the mind to be content, at ease, happy, not filled with greed, that kind of thing. Well, when you do that, you find out that you have to cut out almost everything. That's a real awakening when you do that. I mean, if you give yourself permission, I'll listen to the radio. Well, no, because it causes agitation. It causes unease. TV and movies, that's definitely out. Internet? Absolutely not. No, there's no way. So you're really limited to a very few things that cause the mind to be at ease and content and happy. And for me, it was meditation. It was walking, a great deal of walking. It was practicing my guitar. It was knitting on occasion. And that was about it. I did allow myself to read, which is going to get to clear comprehension. And the reason I allow myself to read is because with mindfulness after a few days, the things that I normally would not want to read because they're too dense for me, they're too scholarly. I was talking to Jerry before and we were talking about our different mind states and, you know, how some people can really be studious and academic and other people, you know, want to be heartfelt. Well, I have struggles with the studious and academic, but when I'm on retreat, I can do it. Mindfulness sets in and I can read all sorts of books that normally I wouldn't even attempt. One of them is, and I brought it with me to show you, which I've been trying to read for years, and I get through about three pages and fall asleep or, you know, find something better to do. It's The Heart of Buddhist Meditation by Nyanaponika Thera. And he was a teacher of Bhikkhu Anālayo's, who's one of my idols. Bhikkhu Anālayo is a scholar, meditating monk who's written many really wonderful papers on the Satipatthana Sutta. So I read this and I realized, God, there's all kinds of treasures in here, you know, and I'm so glad I took the time to really peruse this and get into it. This book is on the Satipatthana Sutta. Does everybody know the Satipatthana Sutta? Very, very briefly. It's what this Vipassana practice is based on. And it is the four foundations of mindfulness. If you take a beginning meditation course in Vipassana practice, this is what you will be taking. It's put in more secular language and not so much the Pali language, but it's essentially the same thing. So the Satipatthana and the four foundations of mindfulness starts with the body and breathing. So this is our base, you know, the home base is being with the body and being with our breath. And then it goes into Vedana, which is feelings. And feelings especially just pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. That's it. Just touching on feelings. And then mental states, which are essentially the weather of the mind. So right now, if we went around and I asked each of you, what is your mental state? You might have difficulty figuring it out. Really see, what is my mental state? But that's what this is asking you to do, is to look carefully as what is really taking place. And this is important because everything you hear, everything you experience is going through that filter of that mental state. And I'll be getting more into that. And then the final one is proliferations of the mind, which is really the elevated states of mind, like the seven factors of awakening, or the not so elevated states of mind, the five hindrances. So it's a long sutta, but it's a very important sutta. And this goes into something, it touches on it, but it goes into the states of mind you should be bringing to your meditation, not the meditation itself, although it certainly seeps into that, but what states of mind should you be bringing into your meditation? And the first, when we are meditating, and you've all heard this term, bare awareness. Everybody heard bare awareness? Anybody here can define it for me? You just had Steve Armstrong for a weekend, and you can't tell me what bare awareness is.
It's dimensional, so I think there are several ways to find words for it. It's not easy to find words for it.
Well, there is a sutta, the Bahiya Sutta, and the Buddha narrowed it down to its essence, and it's, here in Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way, you should train yourself. So essentially, it's saying, you hear a sound in meditation. Soon as the story comes up, you go back to the sound. You eliminate the story to the best of your ability. Not an easy thing to do, but that is bare awareness. Now, when the story comes up, then the instruction is, then you are with that story just as far as how does it feel in the body and what kind of emotions does it evoke. You do not go into the storyline. That is just recreating all the things that we are trying to remove ourselves from that causes suffering in life. So that's bare awareness. And it's what we try to do in meditation. We practice constantly. 10 days ago, Dave, Sarah Bell, and John and I went to a 11-hour meditation retreat at CSP SAC, Level 4 Maximum Security Prison. Longest retreat ever held in a prison. For 11 hours, the men were together. And the instructions by our teacher, Venerable Di Hong, was bear awareness. Just be with what is taking place. You hear the sound of the bell, just be with the bell. And as he instructed, as stories come up of shame, of hatred, of self-loathing, step outside and just see these are stories. Don't get caught up in them. And then come back to just being with your experience. And you have to keep doing this over and over again. This is bare awareness. So what about bare awareness in daily life? What do you think about that? Can you have bare awareness in daily life?
It's hard.
It would be hard.
It really slowed down.
Depends on what's in your presence.
That's Miriam, I think you're right, because if you are alone and you just happen to be sitting on a bus or doing something, yeah, bear awareness. You could practice bear awareness. But if I'm to have a conversation with Michael and I decide I'm going to have bear awareness, I'm going to work with bear awareness as he's telling me something, and I'm just thinking words, 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 and not responding at all, that's not too helpful, you know, for us in daily life. So, yeah, Miriam, you're right. It depends on where you are. If you're interacting with someone, bear awareness is not going to work. It's just it's just not helpful. And this is where clear comprehension comes in, which kind of surprised me because I had never heard it this way. But actually, after reading it, I realized how much sense it made. So how would you define, anybody, how would you define clear comprehension? We hear it all the time in Buddhist practice, clearly comprehending. But what does that really mean?
That's why we're here.
Thank you, Maureen. Nyanaponika Thera defines it this way: clear comprehension is right knowledge or wisdom based on right attentiveness. Now, I think most of us don't really know the definition of clear comprehension. I certainly didn't. I didn't mean to make you all feel foolish, really. I didn't. But I certainly didn't either, because I figured I know what it is. I know, you know, I know when I'm clearly comprehending something, I thought. But after this retreat and reading this book, I realize how little we clearly comprehend. In fact, it's quite a practice in its own right. Because most of us consider ourselves rational human beings that know when things are positive and good for ourselves and others, and we know when things are detrimental to ourselves and others, and you know, that's clearly comprehending. At least that's a thought I had. But what we forget, do you remember I gave a talk a couple months ago about view and not clinging to any view at all? A proponent of the Dharma does not dispute with anyone in the world. And I had people calling and emailing me going, that's impossible. What a teaching that is. But it actually, the more you sit with it, the more it makes sense. And clearly comprehending is, I think, a portion of this. All of you, when you were raised, well, first of all, you're all male or female or identify with male or female. You were born in a certain culture. You were born in a certain race, a gender, all of that stuff. You have different educations. Everything is different for each of us, completely different. And how are we going to come to a view that's truthful with that? We're not all going to come to the same conclusion on almost anything. There's going to be variations. And so this is where clear comprehension comes in. It also takes great account of, the Pali word is mana, and it means conceit, and I've talked about this many times because I think it's the crux of suffering. Conceit is the obsession with ourselves and comparing ourselves to others. And when we start in on view, that comes up as well, whether we know it or not. It's just part of it. So clear comprehension is what we can use in daily life. It's found in the commentaries. It's not found in the sutta itself. And so I'm going to talk about it, and I'm also going to give an example of, I listen to Dharma talks. You know, another great thing about solo retreats, whatever was coming up for me, I could look for a Dharma talk on that particular topic and listen to it. One Dharma talk, which was not a Dharma talk, it was a TED talk. Yes, I can do that. It's my retreat, and I want to listen to a TED talk. And a TED talk I listened to was by this guy named John Francis. I mentioned this at SBMG 12 days ago. And I'm going to bring him into this because, for me, I'm not a scholar. I need examples in everyday life, and how can I use something? And this example of John Francis, which I'm going to come back to, I think might help you too. So clear comprehension of purposeful action is the very first step in developing clear comprehension. Clear comprehension of purposeful action, it sounds easy, but it actually is telling you, can you define what you are wanting to do and leave the I, me, and my mind out of it? Really? That's not an easy thing to do with all of our various situations. As soon as we say, I want, or I need, or I don't like, clear comprehension is gone. So he is saying you have to define it without that. First of all, that leaves out a lot of stuff that we just have to accept. We're not going to clearly comprehend. And secondly, it's very spacious when you start doing that. So I'm going to bring John Francis into this now, this TED Talk that I listened to. And John Francis, in about 78, was living in San Francisco, and I can't remember if he witnessed or he just came upon an oil spill in San Francisco Bay. I think he said he saw two oil tankers collide in this horrible spill in San Francisco Bay. Well, he had been a progressive activist about the environment, one of the first ones, and so he was extremely upset over this. And as he says in his TED Talk, he'd always been very argumentative, always and a brilliant man, but, you know, trying to sway everybody to do what he said was the right thing through arguing with them, showing them how their views are completely wrong and erroneous and how stupid they are. Well, sociology has found, as soon as you start doing that, guess what? People just cling to their views even more. I might be inclined to agree with somebody, but if they're going to start yelling at me, I'm not, you know, I'm backing away from it. So he was very, very upset over this. He was ready to start his arguing again and, you know, looking to blame. And then he realized, you know, I've done this so many times and it hasn't worked. So instead, he decided for one day he would not talk, and for one day he would not ride in a vehicle that used fossil fuel. And he said, that's what I could do. So he did that for a day, and he said, yeah, that felt pretty good. Felt better than arguing with everybody. And he did it a second day, wouldn't ride in a car. And then he decided, I'm not going to talk, and I'm not going to ride in a car till my next birthday, which was 6 months away, and he didn't. He didn't talk or ride in a car for 6 months. And then when that took place, he said, maybe I could make it for a year. And he did. 17 years later, he hadn't talked. And he hadn't ridden in a car or any vehicle that used fossil fuel. In the meantime, he was walking everywhere. I don't know how many times he walked across the United States in 7 years, but he managed 17 years. But he got his master's degree, his PhD, and taught in a college, all without talking. And his classes were filled because he made the students listen to each other, and he listened to them. And he said it was the best education he could have gotten. I'm going to come back to this first clear comprehension of purposeful action. He let go of I want, I hate, This has got this got me upset. Instead, he framed it. The environment is hurting. What can be done? It was no longer, I can't stand this. I've got to change minds. It was a bigger picture. And he saw it clearly. The environment is hurting. What can we do? What can be done to help this? And he decided this was the clearest thing that he could do that might make a difference. He's an extreme example, but one that I really love. The second is clear comprehension of suitability. And this just means, okay, you're comprehending something. Now, what are you going to do about it? And is it suitable? Is it something that is really going to be helpful? How realistic? Nyanaponika Tara calls it the art of the practical, or skillfulness in the choice of right means. John Francis decided what he could personally do was stop riding in cars and stop talking. That was his suitability of means. So these first two are pretty obvious. They're out in the world, you know, looking with a more spacious view, and that's what's a suitable thing to do. The next are starting in to get into our practice more clearly. And the third one is clear comprehension of the domains of mindfulness. And what this means is we want to bring our mindfulness into whatever plan we use to clearly comprehend a situation. In John Francis's case, it was listening. It was listening. You know, another example was just this past Sunday, Dharma Voices for Animals. I was very concerned about animal mistreatment, farm animal mistreatment, as well as climate, you know, with the amount of forests and lands that are being tilled for cattle raising. So they wanted to do something. Well, you could sit and argue. That's going to do a whole lot of good, shaking your finger at people who enjoy meat. So they looked at it as this type of lifestyle and the amount of meat eating we're doing in this country is harmful to the planet. That's it. That was it. The suitability of means was, let's have a vegan cooking demonstration. I was there. I helped plan it. We had 30 people come. Some were vegan, some were not. Everyone enjoyed themselves. People were asking for more information. This made way more sense than, I know I'm right, you got to live this way. So that's suitability of means. And the domain of mindfulness, well, for DVA, for Dharma Voices for Animals, it was tasting. That's the mindfulness. Actually taste and see what you think. And everybody loved what was made. By the way, they were spring rolls and chana masala, and it was delicious. So clear comprehension, the domains of mindfulness. John Francis used listening. Dharma Voices for Animals used tasting. What can you do? What can you do mindfully that is going to enhance your own clear comprehension and hopefully those around you? And then it comes full circle, clear comprehension of reality. And this is understanding there is no permanent abiding self. It goes right back to I, me, and mine again. As soon as we start getting to I, me, and mine, we're away from clear comprehension. So clear comprehension of reality is again emphasizing this I, this conceit that I talked about at the beginning. that as soon as that gets in there and it becomes about me and me getting my way, you're not seeing clearly any longer. There's a Zen definition of enlightenment that I just love, and it's called an appropriate response. And I think that's exactly what this is an appropriate response. Instead of just barreling in and I want it the way I want it, actually looking at a bigger picture, and maybe that's the real default for clear comprehension, is pulling back and seeing the bigger picture. And these four steps help you to do that by taking yourself out of the picture and just seeing what is really taking place. I was thinking about this in personal examples, and one of them that came to mind for me is political divides in our families. You know, there's just so much acrimonious situations in our families due to the polarization of our political parties and our way of thinking, and families that used to be able to get together to have a meal or share whatever, even though they had differing points of view, it's now becoming very, very, very difficult, and more difficult with each day. So I started thinking about this in terms of my own family too, because I've got that situation as well. And I started using these four steps and thinking, okay, how would this work? Okay, so I have relatives, in-laws who all they want to do is argue when we get together about their political point of view. And I don't want to get drawn into it, although you can feel it rising, you just want to do it, but don't want to do that I, me, and mine thing. And so I stepped back and I started thinking, so what would be a bigger picture for this? How do I take the I, me, and mine out of it? And I thought about it, and I said, we were all much happier when this wasn't taking place, when this kind of division wasn't taking place in our family. It would be nice if we could get back to that place again. That was the bigger picture. Okay. Does that make sense? Yeah, instead of, I can't stand the way you're thinking. No, I want to get along with you because we're relatives and we have a lot in common, and this whole political thing will pass. So what would be the suitable means for addressing this? Well, it would be right speech. It would be right speech. And it would be speaking truthfully. And speaking truthfully doesn't mean you're wrong and I'm right. It means I so miss the times when I looked forward to getting together and we didn't have this political infighting. How can anybody disagree with that? It's not about I, me, and mine, although I did say I, but it wasn't I want it this way. It was saying you're valued, and that's disappearing, and that shouldn't happen. And then it would be listening. You know, listening as mindfulness practice about what they have to say about it. And then it gets back to the reality of life is there is no permanent I, me, or mine, so I can take myself out of it. So I wanted, and I've told you this, in fact, my next Dharma talk is going to be on the various teachers in our lives. I wanted to hear from you. When have you feel you've fully comprehended a situation and were able to act skillfully? When you were able to get the I, me, and mine out of it? And maybe it's even easier to ask you, when weren't you able to do that? That's probably easier. And remember, the Buddha said we practice before, during, and after. So there is no I screwed up. No, you just learned afterwards instead of before. That's okay. It's a teaching. So I told you this was going to be a very short Dharma talk because I'm burned out a little bit and I didn't have time to prepare a whole lot. So I was hoping I would hear from you about what you have found in your life. What worked when you got yourself out of the way in situations where you really needed to see things in a much more clear way, or what didn't work? Yes.
So I can give a situation, but I also had a practice question with it. So my mother lives out of state, and she was coming to visit, but she always flies into San Francisco because it's cheaper, sees some family there, and then drives up to Sacramento. And it was a Friday, and I told her, get on the road before noon, or you're going to get stuck in traffic. Knowing full well that she would have lunch with relatives there and drag it out to like 2 o'clock and then call me and complain about all the traffic, which is what happened. I say this with all the love in my heart. And before Dharma practice, I would say, Mom, I told you to get on the road before noon, but instead I think I clearly comprehended the situation and simply listened to the complaints and wished her well and suggested some, like a Starbucks along the way or something that she might stop at, take a break or something like that. However, like, the negative feeling tone for me throughout that conversation was really high.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I wanted to say I told you so, and I didn't want to hear her complaints, which were entirely foreseeable. And so, while I'm glad I engaged in right speech and listened and what have you, it was extraordinarily difficult. And there would have been a sort of relief if I had said, I told you so, even though I know that would have been destructive, kind of from the perspective of clear comprehension. I just wonder if that engenders any thoughts. Because it's really difficult to maintain that.
Yeah. I think that's where practice comes in. And anybody else, please, if you have solutions for Jeff, be sure to state them. But, we've all been in those situations where we know this is not going to do any good to, you know, sit there and I told you so. Afterwards, I just sit, literally just sit, feel the tension in my own body, feel I wish I had said I told you so, but I knew this would not accomplish anything. And just feel it, I just feel it start to leave, you know, those body sensations leaving just by paying attention to them. I'm doing this more and more and more. I mean, not just sitting in the morning, in the evening, but at times like that and investigating it completely. And I'm telling you, I think mindfulness is just miraculous because when you shine a light on it, it does just tend to completely fall apart. So that's what I would suggest when you end up in situations like that. I think you were skillful in the way you handled your mother. Now you have to handle yourself. So now you have to be kind to yourself. And I think that's the best way to do it. Yeah. Yeah, Vic.
I think the closest that I've ever come to that, and it certainly wasn't perfect, is when I agreed to be the primary caregiver to my wife who was in hospice for 11 months. It was... I'm going to leave it right there.
Yeah. Do you feel you were clearly comprehending the situation? Is that what was going on?
As best as I could, and not all the time.
Yeah.
Things that I would never have
there's something that there's you kind of get into the, first off, full disclosure, I read the book. there's something that does happen when you're with someone and you really have a responsibility and you really want to be there just for that person. You know? And after doing that for a while, it really becomes almost second nature that you're not there anymore. there's just this, he calls it the fair registering, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's part of the process of just being fully present for that person. I think we experienced that, or at least I do, in the prison.
Mm-hmm.
When I Monday in the women's facility at Folsom, there were some women who just had their stories, and they needed me to be there listening fully. And so it's something that happens that I'm just not there anymore. It's just all I hear their stories and it's almost like so that I think that gets fairly close as I can to clear comprehension. There's my normal judgments and nagging thoughts are dismissed of necessity because there's something quite urgent when somebody is needing your complete full attention.
Yeah.
Almost desperate.
Yeah.
A situation where it occurs.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm brand new. I'm listening to the couple of people, but you, thank you so much. My question isn't about an example. I never do before, during, and after at the same time. I get pieces of each one every now and then. I guess my question is, you were speaking before about the interpersonal relationships. It's kind of my job, it doesn't matter what it is, it's just that my job, I'm supposed to have a pain rather than it's really getting to me.
Yeah.
I don't want to have a pain.
Right.
Your life is not something I can tell you. I can only do certain things. So I guess my question is somewhere in there.
I don't have an answer. I ran a business too, and I disliked having to have an opinion on everything. But it seems in a capitalist society, you know, we're put in this role, and I think all we can do is be as skillful as we can, try to take ourselves out of the picture as much as we can and look at, as he is saying, look at it in a more spacious way as much as we can in the society we live in. You know, this is why the monks and nuns left, you know, get me out of here. You know, they wanted to go off and practice because of exactly the kind of thing you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we do the best we can.
Yeah.
Yeah, Michael.
I've been trying to think more of a kind of a mental landscape you bring to a situation where you can have clear comprehension. And I can't think of any examples where I've never had any, but it seems to me the more ease and stability of mind you have when you're receiving something, that's kind of almost like a prerequisite to be able to have.
Absolutely.
Right. So I don't know why you happen to have ease at that present moment, but you know, if you're already in a situation where you feel challenged by your mother, I think the flag asks, I may not have clear comprehension right now, so you have to do the best you can, because we usually don't have clear comprehension. But I think whatever your practice or whatever you do to get that has to already be there before the situation arises, right? Or else you're kind of...
Absolutely, and he says exactly that in this book. The prerequisite is always your practice. Is always, and he said, working with bare awareness, you know, and constantly seeing exactly what's taking place rather than adding on to it. So when you go out in the world, you're able to do this and have a more spacious view of what's taking place. But yeah, it starts with your practice. He also, and Dave, you might clarify this, I believe he said, as you do this more and more, wisdom develops, and you no longer have to think in terms of steps. You just know what to do because you have been practicing in this way.
Or you know what not to do.
Or you know what not to do, right.
No, I could add a counterexample. A lot of the fall I was in, I don't know how to describe it, but my sense of ease or well-being was unusually sort of low, and I could just see my mind kind of continually running into these more negative, judgmental patterns that... Actually, I had very little skill to deal with because I didn't find myself consciously being like that much.
Right, right.
But, you know, once you see that it's rolling along, you say, well, I'm along for the ride. Make the best you can.
That's right. I have my own example, too, when I was on retreat after about 10 days, and now I'm still, boy, I've got it together. You know, yeah, I'm a yogi. Yeah, I'm to be admired. This is really great. And still mine, and I'm happy. And, well, anyway, something happened. And I'm not going to go into what, but 2 minutes, gone. Gone. You know, upset, got to handle this. What happened? You know, what happened to my mind? Now, the good thing about this was, it was actual, this is another confession, I do keep a journal, because I like looking back on where, how I handled different situations and what happened. It actually gives me hope, you know. So, in this particular situation that had me rattled up, I recovered in about 11 hours. I read back, and previously it had taken 6 months, you know, with a similar situation. So that's, you know, as I started getting really just self-flagellating and, you know, God, you were so mindful and everything was so great and look at you just coming apart. But it came back together again very, very quickly. So, you know, that it's cumulative, which I also put in my journal. You think nothing is happening. You think absolutely nothing is happening. And sometimes, why am I doing this? You know, nothing is happening. And then you realize a couple months, years later, how you respond to situations is so completely different than what you had years prior that you realize this is it. This is what they say. Don't expect anything. Just practice. Just keep practicing. It makes all the difference in the world. Nobody has any clear comprehension or non-clear comprehension. Yes, Tom.
When you were talking, I was thinking in terms of equanimity, when you talked about spaciousness, emotional and spiritual spaciousness. And I was thinking of a prison situation, too, not with PP3, before I did PP3, when I was doing 12-step. And a man told me about he was in Innocence Project, and he was convicted of a double homicide, and he was clearly innocent. And he convinced me he was clearly innocent. I just didn't react. But listen to them, you know, it's like with equanimity as much as I could.
Yeah.
And also volunteer every morning at a place downtown to deal with people. And I'm a guest advocate. And every week, I lost my SSI card, I lost my Direct Express card, I lost my California ID, I lost my EBT card. It's difficult, but all I can do is listen to them.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
I think, you know, trying to practice that, especially the emotional spaciousness, is really the key. And that's
yeah. Right.
I also heard a guy say one time, I never miss an opportunity to keep my mouth shut.
That's true. And those of us who've gone through chaplaincy training, I think that's the biggest take from it, is having the willingness, being able to be present in any situation. I have a good friend, this has stuck with me. I was just sharing it with somebody the other day, and she had said, you'll be very surprised who's with you when you're on your deathbed. And I thought about that because I've been with a lot of strangers as they died, as family and people were too bereft to do anything. And it's being present. It's just being willing to be present. No big talent, just, I'll be there, just as you said. Anybody? Yeah, Maureen. And then Linda.
Comes up for me when we're talking about this is that fix-it mentality that we feel like
yes.
We need to know and we need to right. Have a plan and we need to and just coming to grips with that we don't know.
That's right. And we can't fix everything. In fact, there's little we can fix. I'm beginning to find out.
And that illusion of control, how truly illusory it is. And once you really, you know, can even let down your resistance to accepting that that really is what's true, then you get a little bit of a chance to be able to see that being present really is often what's needed and what can be done.
Right. And often it's the only thing you can do, because you're right, you can't fix it. So often, but you can be present. That's it. Thank you. Linda.
Well, I was just thinking about my own life, my one disabled son, and I was thinking how he calls me nearly every other day, which, you know, is wonderful in a way, because he needs me and he loves me and I'm important to him, but there's a lot of times he calls me and I'm you know, he always says, how are you? And I say, well, I'm in the middle of this and I'm in the middle of that because I am, you know. And then I know that there's this part of me that can resist. Oh, I'm about to give you 20 minutes. And I was right in the middle of this. But I think I'm just, I've been, you know, in the last period of time, much better at just surrendering to, well, this is what I'm doing right now. This is what I'm going to be doing. And I'm just going to give it my full attention. I'm just present. And, you know, I'm going to hear things like what I had for lunch today, maybe. And that's going to be sort of not too exciting to me. But on the other hand, it's a connection
right. That's
meaningful. And I think the real key there to be present is just to let go of everything else, just to surrender of the me there who thinks, you know, that something is important that I'm doing. And it really brings a beautiful kind of an experience of beauty because it's just a letting go and a being present.
Yeah.
And also a gratitude of, well, he's here, you know, he's still here. And I don't know how long you'll be here, but it's so wonderful that he's here. So I think it just completely transforms. And I guess that's the closest I can come at this point. It's sort of, I think that's clear comprehension.
Yeah, right.
In
that right.
particular condition or situation of my life.
Thank you. You, Karen.
Yeah, I more and more see that where I really will trip myself up is when I think I need to get
kind of, you know, because that then brings in the I me, and if I can remind myself, forget about that. Forget about that. Abandon any hope of any result. Then it's when I can be present. And that phrase, abandon all hope of results, has sort of become an ongoing meditation in and of itself that I sometimes forget to use and then get myself
right.
Really screwed up in something. But it's a very helpful thing to keep going back to, because it takes me away from all the things that I think I ought to do this, or, you know, there ought to be a solution for that, or blah, blah, blah. All the things that so often our society tells us, yeah,
right.
There ought to be, and you ought to accomplish this.
Yeah. Yep. But we do the best we can,
yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And it might work and it might not, but we do the best we can. Yep. And I know you do. All right. 9:02. So let's do a final metta and dedication of merit. May we have the ability to see clearly as situations arise. May we not delve into selfishness, but spaciousness, and understand that we can fix some things and we can't fix everything, but we can be present. We can be a presence for all living beings, be helpful and kind. And may all of us in this room, and may all living beings everywhere, be safe and protected from all types of harm and danger. May we all be peaceful and happy and healthy and strong. May we all have ease in this life. And may we all in this lifetime become completely free from suffering. So thank you all for coming.